We come now to the little book of Zephaniah. I told you at the beginning when we took up Nahum that we were putting together three remarkable little books, Nahum, Habakkuk, and Zephaniah. And I'm sure that most of you now agree that the first two books, Nahum and Habakkuk, are unusual books. Well, Zephaniah is not far behind. In fact, it's not behind at all. It's another remarkable book that we've come to. Now, I do not think the little book of Zephaniah will ever take the place of John 3:16 or the Gospel of John as number one in Bible popularity. But the contents of this little book have never been familiar. I doubt whether the little book's been read very much. I'm going to ask a question that I asked a long time ago regarding another book, and that is, how many of you have ever heard a sermon on Zephaniah? I dare say that few of you have ever done that. I asked that question several years ago when I was pastor one Sunday morning when I was going to preach on it, and out of a congregation of between 2,500 and 3,000, there were probably two hands that were put up that had heard a sermon on Zephaniah. Now, that's not due to the mediocrity or the inferiority of this little book, I can assure you. But it's been neglected because, actually, its theme was known. I think it would be appreciated. And that is, it has the same theme as the Gospel of John has. John is called the Apostle of Love, and he is an Apostle of Love. But we come to a little book, and he is the Prophet of Love. Now, it's going to be difficult for you to believe that. It's hard to believe it, but let me give you a verse from that. We're acquainted with John 3:16. How about Zephaniah 3:17? Listen to this. The Lord thy God in the midst of thee is mighty. He will save. He'll rejoice over thee with joy. He'll rest in his love. He will joy over thee with singing. He'll rest in his love. Lovely, isn't it? Well, may I say to you, this little book is a little different, though, than the Gospel of John. This verse I've given you is just like a small island that is sheltered in the midst of a storm-tossed sea. Because much of this little book of Zephaniah seems rather harsh and cruel. It seems like it's fury poured out. And the reason for that is there's just too much judgment that's in this little book here. He begins chapter 3 of Zephaniah with, "Woe to her that is filthy and polluted to the oppressing city." And my, starts out in that vein, and that's not very popular today. Now, how can love be the theme? It's like looking for the proverbial needle in a haystack. I think I can illustrate this by telling you a detective story, giving you a mystery story. Now, that seems a very peculiar way to begin Zephaniah. Well, let me give you a mystery story here. And it's going to help us understand this little book. Now, I want to brief you here on the very terrifying scene, by the way. And we are going to look now at the dark side of love. Now, here is my story. It was late at night in a suburban area of one of our great cities of America. A child lay restless in her bed. A man with a very severe and stern look, he stealthily entered a bedroom, and he softly approached her bed. And the moment the little girl saw him, a terrified look came over her face, and she began to scream. And her mother rushed into the room and went over to her, and the trembling child threw her arms about her. But the man withdrew to the telephone, and he called someone who was evidently an accomplice, and in a very soft voice made some sort of an arrangement. And hastily, the man re-entered the room. He tore the child from the mother's arms, and he rushed out to a waiting car, and the child was sobbing, and he attempted to stifle her cries. He drove madly down street after street until he finally pulled up before a large, sinister, and foreboding-looking building. All was quiet. The building was partially dark, but there was one room upstairs ablaze with light, and the child was hurriedly taken inside, up to the lighted room, and put into the hands of the man with whom the conversation had been held over the telephone in the hallway. In turn, the child was handed over to another accomplice, and this time it was a woman. And these two took her into an inner room, and the man who had brought her was left outside in the hallway. Inside the room, the man that took her in there, he took a long, sharp, gleaming knife, and he plunged it into the vitals of that little child, and she lay as if she were dead. Now, I wonder what your reaction is at this point. Maybe you're saying, well, I certainly hope they'll catch that criminal who abducted that little child and is responsible for such an awful crime. May I say to you, friends, I have not described to you the depraved and degraded action of a debased mind. I have not taken a chapter out of the life of a man in cell 2455 death row. I haven't told you a story that comes from one of these murder mysteries that we have too much probably on TV today. I have not related to you the sordid and sadistic crime of a psychopathic criminal. On the contrary, I have described to you a tender act of love. In fact, I can think of no more sincere demonstration of love than I've described to you. Now, I'm sure you're amazed when I say that. Now, let me fill in here, and then you'll understand. You see, that little girl had awakened in the night with severe abdominal pains. She had been subject to such attacks, and her parents were watching her very carefully. The doctor had said to do that. And it was actually her father who had rushed into the room. And the little girl knew that she might have to make that trip to the hospital. And when the father rushed into the room, she screamed, of course. And he talked to the specialist about it. And when he saw the suffering of the little girl, you see, he went to the telephone, and he called the family physician, and he arranged to meet him at the hospital. And he had rushed his own little girl down to the hospital, and he handed her over to the family physician. And the doctor had taken her into the operating room with the nurse, and he performed an emergency surgery. Through it all, every move and every act of that father was of tender love, anxious care, and a wise decision. I have described to you the dark side of love, but love nevertheless. Now, the father loved that child just as much on that dark night when he took her to the hospital and delivered her to the surgeon's knife as he did the next week when he brought her flowers and candy. It was just as much a demonstration of deep affection when he delivered her into the hands of the surgeon as it was the next week when he brought her home and delivered her into the arms of her mother. My friend, love places the eternal security and permanent welfare of the object of love above any transitory or temporary comfort, a present pleasure down here upon this earth. In other words, love seeks the best interests of the beloved. That's important. That's what this little book of Zephaniah is all about. It's the dark side of love. Now, may I pause just to say this? I have a book entitled The Dark Side of Love, and that's a little book we'll send to you for those of you who are supporting the program. But now let's understand that the notes and outlines, you don't have to send anything to get those, because we want everyone to study the Bible. This would be just a supplement for those who believe in this ministry, and if they do and want the book, they'd want to have part in supporting it, of course. Now let me move on here. Now, in our nation today, we have come through a period when the love of God has been exaggerated out of all proportion to the other attributes of our God. And it's been presented in such a way that the love of God is a weakness rather than a strength. It has been presented on the sunny side of the street with nothing of the other side ever mentioned. There is a love of God presented that sounds to me like the doting of grandparents rather than the vital and vigorous concern of a parent for the best interests of the child. The liberal preacher today has chanted like a parrot. He has used shop-worn cliches. He's taken tired adjectives, and he said, God is love, God is love, God is love, until he's made it saccharine sweet. And he has not told about the dark side of the love of God. He has watered love down, making it sickening rather than stimulating, causing it to slop over on every side like a sentimental feeling rather than an abiding concern for the object of love. Now, let me add this. God deals with us according to our need. I want you to notice that there is the dark side of the love of God. The great physician will put his child on the operating table, and he'll use the surgeon's knife when he sees a tumor of transgression or a deadly virus sapping our spiritual lives, or when he sees the cancerous growth of sin. He does not hesitate to deal with us severely. We must learn this fact early. He loves us just as much when he's subjecting us to surgery as when he sends us candy and flowers and brings us into the sunshine. And sometimes the great physician will operate without giving us so much as a sedative. But you can always be sure of one thing. When he does this, he'll pour in the balm of Gilead. When he sees that it is best for you and for me to go down through the valley of suffering, that it will be for our eternal welfare, he'll not hesitate to let us go down through the dark valley. Someone has expressed it in these lines. Is there no other way, O God, except through sorrow, pain, and loss, to stamp Christ's likeness on my soul? No other way except the cross? And then a voice stills all my soul, as still the waves of Galilee. Canst thou not bear the furnace, if midst the flames I walk with thee? I bore the cross. I know its weight. I drank the cup I hold for thee. Canst thou not follow where I lead? I'll give thee strength. Lean hard on me. My friend, he loves us most when he's operating on us. That's what we saw, you remember, back in Hebrews 12:6. For whom the Lord loveth, he chasteneth, he child trains, he disciplines. And there's another figure that the Lord Jesus presented yonder in the upper room, and you will find that in the Gospel of John, the Gospel of Love. John 15, verses 1 and 2. He says, I'm the genuine vine. My Father is the vine dresser. Every branch in me that beareth not fruit, he taketh away. And every branch that beareth fruit, he prunes it, that it may bring forth more fruit. May I say to you, we must remember that the Father reaches into your life and mine and prunes out that which is not fruit-bearing, and it hurts. But as a Puritan divine once said years ago, the husbandman is never so close to the branch as when he's trimming it. The Father is never more close to you, my friend, than when he's reaching in and taking out of your heart and life those things that offend. It was Spurgeon who noticed a weather vane that a farmer had on his barn. It was an unusual weather vane, for on it the farmer had the words, God is love. And Mr. Spurgeon asked him, he says, do you mean by this that God's love is as changeable as the wind? The farmer shook his head. No, he said, I do not mean that God's love changes like that. I mean that whichever way the wind blows, God is love. Today it may be the soft wind from the south that he brings to blow across your life, for he loves you. And tomorrow he may let the cold blasts from the north blow over your life. And if he does, he still loves you. It has been expressed in a very wonderful poem, and I've used it before. I hesitate to use it again, but I want to bring out this poem. God hath not promised skies always blue, flower-strewn pathways all our lives through. God hath not promised we shall not know toil and temptation, trouble and woe. He hath not told us we shall not bear many a burden, many a care. And then I lift out the last stanza. But God hath promised strength for the day, rest for the laborer, light for the way, grace for the trials, help from above, unfailing sympathy, undying love. Beloved, if you are a child of God and you're in a place of suffering, be assured and know that God loves you. Regardless of how it may appear, he loves you, and you can't ever change that. And that's what we have now in the little prophecy of Zephaniah. It sets forth the dark side of the love of God. I have a notion that very few of you, when I asked the question a moment ago, had you ever heard a sermon on Zephaniah? Very few of you, I'm sure, would have put up your hand. And since it presents the dark side of God's love, I can well understand how it would be unpopular, because it opens with rumblings of judgment, the judgment of God that's coming upon this earth. And you find that as we get into it, this little book. When I was pastor in downtown Los Angeles, it was on Mother's Day. I looked down in the congregation, because that was the day that we recognized mothers, and you could see that many of them were there, and they were dressed a little special for that day. Many of them had on corsages, but one mother that sat out there, she didn't look as happy as the others looked. In fact, there was a note of sorrow on her face, and she had a beautiful corsage on, a beautiful orchid corsage. Fact of the matter is, it was the biggest one I've ever seen. And I knew where it came from. She had a son in the East, and he's a prominent businessman. He's high up in government circles, as well as the business world. But he's not a Christian. In fact, he turns a deaf ear to his mother's pleading, and she prays for him constantly. She's asked others to pray for him. And one Sunday morning after a message, with tears streaming down her cheeks, she said to me, "Oh, Dr. McGee, I pray that God will save my boy. I pray that he'll save him, even if he has to put him on a sick bed." And then, almost fiercely, she said, "Even if he has to kill him, I pray that God will save him before it's too late." And I say to you, that's a very strong statement to make. And suppose that there had been listening a private detective or a detective from the police department. Would he have arrested her for making that kind of a statement? No, he could not. He could not arrest her at all. Why? Well, because that wasn't a threat. That was actually a statement of love. It was because she loved that boy that she was actually willing to to give him up and let him go down through the doorway of death, if it meant the salvation of his soul. May I say to you that the little book of Zephaniah presents this aspect of God. And actually, I think that we need to recognize, as I called attention, that our idea today of God is he's sort of a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, that he is a God of love, but there's another nature to him. He's almost a different person. He's a God of judgment. But there is, all the way through this little book, and this is a book of judgment, and you won't find judgment enunciated in a more harsh manner than you find in this book here. There actually are two thoughts that stand out in this brief book. The first one is this: the day of the Lord occurs 7 times in this book. The fact of the matter is, that's the theme of the book, the day of the Lord. Obadiah and Joel, they were the first of the writing prophets to use this phrase, the day of the Lord. Now, Zephaniah is the last one to use it. And as I say, he uses it more than any other prophet. In fact, it occurs 7 times in this little book. And there are other references to it, but not that particular phrase, by the way. And it has a particular application to the great tribulation period, which precedes the kingdom, but it includes the kingdom. In fact, the great tribulation is ended by the coming of Christ personally to the earth to establish the millennial kingdom. And all of that is included in the day of the Lord. And we need, therefore, to keep that before us in this little book, because the emphasis here is upon judgment. You see the first two prophets, Joel and Obadiah. Joel, for instance, you remember his book opens with that great locust plague. And he likens that locust plague to the day of the Lord that is coming in the future. And he enlarges upon it. He says, the day of the Lord is not light, it's darkness. That's the way God's day begins. In fact, that's the way God writes salvation. It's on the black background of man's sin that God writes in letters of light the wonderful gospel story for you and for me. Now, Zephaniah, he is the last of the writing prophets that uses this expression, the day of the Lord. In other words, the prophets begin with that expression. All of them refer to it. And now you come here to Zephaniah, and he prophesied during the days of Josiah. And that was the period that actually was the last spiritual movement that took place in the kingdom. There was a revival during that time. It wasn't a great one. It didn't last long, but there was a revival. And this man had known something of the reign, actually, of Ammon, an evil king, and the reign of Manasseh, a terrible king, and he knew the reign of these men. And this man sees that judgment is coming upon his nation and upon his people. And his message sounds very harsh, by the way. Now, the second thought that's in this little book, and it's the word jealousy. It only occurs twice. And jealousy, as it refers to God, is on a little different level and different plane than it is for you and me. In our jealousy, we seek actually to do evil. But God is jealous of those that are his own. He's jealous of mankind. He created him. He's purchased a redemption for him and made it possible for him to be saved. And God is jealous. It's not his will that any should perish. He wants them to be saved. He's jealous of them. But when they don't turn to him, he's going to judge them. And the thing this book makes clear as we'll go through it, God is glorified in judging as well as God is glorified in saving. Now, a great many people don't see that at all. They can't understand how that could possibly be true. But you remember over in the 38th and 39th chapters of Ezekiel, that is the time that God is going to judge Russia in the future. And he says that it will be in the last days, the latter days. And in chapter 38 of Ezekiel, verse 16, it reads like this, "Thou shalt come up against my people of Israel as a cloud to cover the land. It shall be in the latter days, and I will bring thee against my land, that the heathen may know me, when I shall be sanctified in thee, O God, before their eyes." In other words, God says, I intend to judge this godless system, this godless nation, and when I do, I will be glorified in that judgment. Now, that is a tremendous statement to make, and also, for a great many people, it's a bitter pill for them to follow. But it might be well for us to learn to think God's thoughts after him, realizing that our thoughts are not his thoughts, and our ways are not his ways at all.